Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Oh, well, good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay, and this week we're exploring what's wrong with economics with Rob Levy, an economist from UCL. Good morning, Rob.
Morning. Hello there.
Lovely to have you. Now, it's true, isn't it? Economically, we are living in unprecedented times. I know an economist, and he said that he thinks future textbooks will be written about this time. Like, we're the first generation in the history of human development not to be better off on average than our parents. We've got imposed austerity, and Europe has interest rates of zero. In fact, in Denmark, the interest rates are negative. So that means you're like paying the banks to store your money for you, as if, you know, I'm lending you £10. Normally, you know, I'd charge interest, you'd give me back 11. But actually, no, no, keep 50p this time. Just give me back 9.50. Like, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a few things that you mentioned there are weird. I think the most striking thing, I think you can sum everything else up by saying that we're the first generation in human history not to be better off than our parents. I mean, that's pretty crazy. And I always used to think that it would be nice to have been a teenager at a cool period. You know, like if you were like 18 in 68 or something, that's a really good time. And the thing that really bums me out about this period is that, like, in 40 years' time, people are going to be like, so when were you young and in your prime? And I'll be like, oh yeah, in the 2000s and 2010s. And they'll be like, oh, bummer. That's a boring
well,
time to be
everything.
In your prime.
Oh, I don't know if it's boring, but yeah, it's definitely not the most fun. It's interesting economically,
it's
right?
It's certainly very interesting, yeah.
And you are on a crusade to introduce a more critical approach to economics, focusing on data-driven economics, which you've got a blog about, haven't you?
Yeah, datadrivenEconomics.wordpress.com. How did I think of that URL? It's brilliant, isn't it?
So we'll be hearing more about the problems in economics, what's wrong with austerity, and what Rob thinks we can do to get it right later in the show. But for our experiment this week, any of you listening at home that want to take part, all you'll need is £10, £10 notes best, and two random people. So run out onto the street and see who you can find. And of course, we want to hear from you, so we've got our weekly brain teaser. Okay, this one, it's a bit more like a riddle. A man takes his car to a hotel. Upon reaching the hotel, he is immediately declared bankrupt. Why? If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio. And we will be revealing the answer at the end of the show. Rob, you are looking stumped.
No, I was just trying to think of a funny person who I could say, because it's this person, and then, you know, and they would be bankrupt, but I can't think of anyone.
Okay, well, we'll move on from that one.
Killer radio, that, isn't it?
So today is your mixtape. What song are we going with first?
Okay, this is my favourite Jackson 5 song, and I feel upset about the existence of this song because I lived for so long not knowing that it existed. I feel like a lot of my life was wasted. This is Who's Loving You by the Jackson 5, and the Rhodes organ intro makes me do crazy stuff.
Irving Fisher said in October 1929 that he believed that equities had reached a permanently high plateau. Less than 2 weeks later, stocks plunged and didn't reach the highs they fell from for 25 years.
Wow. That is the first of our economic predictions that weren't right from producer Yaz. That's crazy.
Thanks, producer Yaz.
You're welcome.
So, Rob, I feel like it's important. It's the beginning of the show. And for any listeners that don't know, we should go back to basics / I don't know.
Right.
So can you explain nice and concisely, what is economics?
Well, there are three things in economics, it divides into three disciplines. And like any good, real scientific discipline, the members of the sub-disciplines absolutely hate each other. So it's...
there's a lot of inner rivalry.
There's politics right from the start of this story. Broadly, they are macroeconomics, which deals with countries and governments and central banks and trade and all that kind of big stuff. Then there's microeconomics, which deals with households and firms and people and decisions that people make and how they spend their money. And then there's something which I think euphemistically is called econometrics, which is basically statistics. So how do you measure economic questions?
Cool. And they're all looking at like money, basically.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be about money, actually. The one thing that economists love to hate is when people say, oh, you're an economist, right, what should I do with my, you know, $5,000 I've got in the bank or whatever.
Yeah.
Actually, economics is supposed to be about human interactions. It's supposed to be about how do humans behave when resources are scarce. So when there's not enough stuff to go around and decisions have to be made about who gets what and how people interact with each other, that's what economics is supposed to be all about.
The classic, like, supply and demand.
Exactly, yeah. So there's only a certain amount of stuff. We all want some of the stuff. What happens?
And so macro is looking at that on a big scale, like country to country.
Yeah, that's right. So we've got loads of sugarcane, but hardly any lasers. And you've got tons of laser equipment, but no sugarcane. Let's call the whole thing off / do international trade. Yeah, so yes.
No, that's great. That was a really good explanation. I think that is a common misconception that it's just about money, but you're right.
Yeah, well, I think
The
reason why people think it's about money is because economists like to try and measure things whenever they can. So they like it to be quantifiable. And one of the easiest ways to quantify human interaction is by looking at the money that's involved, because you can measure money and you can see it. So I think that economists get excited about money because it kind of represents a level of human interaction. So if I'm willing to give you 100 of my hard-earned pounds, so that's already half of the fee that I'm being paid just to be on this radio show, for example. So if I'm willing to give you 50% of my fee, I must really, you know, something must be important to me. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it means that an economist can say, wow, you know, he values half of his fee's worth of money on whatever. So I think that's why money became central to economics, because it's just easy to count and everybody knows what it means. Otherwise you're dealing in difficult to describe things like units of happiness or units of satisfaction.
Yeah, exactly, because how can you give value without like some sort of arbitrary measure that everyone agrees on?
Well, I mean, that is an active question in economics, that there is a whole thing about utility theory and the idea that utility being the happiness that you gain from a certain situation. So I would gain utility from a donut, but I would also gain utility from having access to healthcare, let's say. So
that's,
it's this
true.
One thing which is supposed to cover every aspect of human
that,
satisfaction,
yeah,
and happiness.
I'm just getting the MasterCard advert in my head. For everything else, there's MasterCard, but
exactly.
Some things are priceless.
Exactly. For everything else, there's this wishy-washy concept called utility that we can measure, so it's all fine. So economists are still wondering whether or not that actually is a thing and whether you can measure it. And like, if I have a utility score of 10 and you have a utility score of 11, does that mean you're happier than I am? Or does that just mean that your scale is different to mine? So these are active questions.
Yeah, complicated. Now, yeah, you told me before the show that there are these three strands and that each of them has a problem. So I'm dying to know, what are the problems with the different strands?
Okay, well, all three strands are problematic and in very different and interesting ways. Macroeconomics is problematic, and the best way to describe how problematic macroeconomics is that literally the day before yesterday, I read a paper that's just come out by a guy called Paul Romer, who is like a big guy in macroeconomics. He's like one of the names, one of the people that people have heard of. And he wrote a paper called What's Wrong with Macroeconomics? Mm-hmm. And in it, he basically slays the entire discipline, saying it's a pseudoscience. They're basically making it all up.
Oh, God.
The central questions of macroeconomics are still not really answered. So the problem with macroeconomics is that whether or not you believe this guy's critique, the fact that a major player is able to publish a thing saying, I think it's all balls, whatever you think about the discipline, whatever you think about that critique, that's problematic for the discipline. And there's been counter-arguments and counter-counter-arguments.
Hasn't it been described as, like, similar to alchemy?
Yes. So it's the problem with macroeconomics is that you have a theory, and you have a theory about the way that the world works, and every time the theory is not adhered to, you can say, oh, well, that's something outside of the model happened. It's because there was a war, or it's because of the Obama government or something.
Making excuses for why your model didn't work.
So there's always a reason. Because the world is complicated and there's stuff going on left, right and centre everywhere all the time, you can always say, well, of course the model didn't work in the 2008-2009 situation. We were in the middle of the biggest financial crisis the world has ever seen.
But so crisis shouldn't have happened within the model.
Well, so here's the problem is that, you know, what is it worth anything to have a model of a kind of calm sea and knowing how the sea behaves when it's calm, when you know that there are storms and you know that there's wind.
And sometimes and you know the waves get really big.
Exactly. And if you're the captain of a ship, you might as well start off by acknowledging that sometimes the sea can be choppy.
Yeah.
And I think the macroeconomics has a massive problem with that. And I have sympathy for that because it's difficult to do. If you're trying to come up with a nice, easy... Because as with all economists, we're still looking for equations which you can solve with pencil and paper. I mean, I'm barely exaggerating with that. We're looking for models that are simple enough that you can solve the maths with pencil and paper. So that's great, and that's a noble aim, particularly when computers don't exist yet for 50 years, i.e. in 1900, that's a great noble aim.
Yeah.
I think that now that computers do exist, maybe we could have more complicated models. The complexity of the real world. Yeah. So I think macroeconomics... Okay, so, I mean, let me just give you one tiny example, then I'll stop talking about it.
No, I love it, Karen.
There is a debate in macroeconomics right now as to whether or not the central bank can affect interest rates. Now...
Okay, I'm already a little bit lost.
Yes. It doesn't matter whether you know what interest rates are or whether you know what the central bank is. The fact is that the central bank is one of the major players in macroeconomics. So that when you look at macroeconomics, you're either looking at countries and governments or you're looking at central banks. And that's basically it. Those are the major players. So one of your major players has basically exactly one role, and that is to set interest rates. And that basically decides how excitable people get about the idea of borrowing money. So if interest rates are very low, companies, etc., get very excited about the idea of borrowing money because it's super cheap.
So
then companies borrow loads of money, and they do loads of investment, and that means that they employ loads more workers, and that means that those workers can buy houses and goods and services and stuff, and that means that the economy generally heats up. So heating up and cooling down is a way that economists like to describe this kind of transition from, like, no one doing anything to now frenetic activity. So the idea is supposed to be that if the central bank lowers interest rates, that makes it cheap to borrow. That means that everyone wants to do their projects. All that idea that I had, or that time I was thinking about having an extension done, maybe I'll do it now because money's cheap. So in other words, it doesn't cost me very much to borrow because I don't have to pay very much back.
That's such a hilarious idea of money being cheap.
Let's get on, let's do stuff. Yeah, let's have that extension built. Let's build that factory or do it, whatever. So it's supposed to create this kind of frenetic economic activity. And obviously with each piece of economic activity comes a whole load of sub-economic activity. So if I decide to have my extension done, that means that my builder then goes from sitting at home to working and earning money. And that means that he or she can then spend that money elsewhere. They can buy coffee and do whatever they like to do.
It just peps the system up a bit.
Exactly. So you get this frenetic activity. I'm imagining right now a kind of like a frenetic ant's nest when it's been shaken and everyone's running around. The idea is, and then obviously the inverse is true as well. So if the central bank is worried that there's too much running around and everyone's going a bit crazy, and a good example of that is suddenly everyone's feeling like super confident, so they go and buy a house. But maybe they don't have enough money really to buy the house, but because interest rates are so super low that they're like, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't cost me anything to buy a house. I might as well do it.
Yeah.
So they'll go out and buy houses. So suddenly there's no houses anymore. So that sends house prices through the roof. This is a supply and demand concept. If everyone wants to buy something, it's more expensive. So that's a good example of where the central bank's like,
has this one decision and it affects so many things.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. So it has one role and it only has one lever to pull, and that is setting interest rates. And it's been doing that for 30 years with varying degrees of success. But in theoretical macroeconomics, there's still a question as to whether the central bank actually can influence the interest rate or not. Because theoretically, they shouldn't be able to, for reasons I'm not going to bore you with. But that is still a theoretical discussion. So things right at the core of how you would expect macroeconomics to get from the university into policy, i.e. what should we do,
are still being debated.
They're still being debated. So macroeconomics is mega problematic.
Wow. Okay, so we're going to go to your next song, and then we'll come back to microeconomics, which is actually quite related to our experiment, so it's kind of perfect. So what is your next song?
My next song is As by Stevie Wonder. It's off Songs in the Key of Life, which if you haven't been listening to Songs in the Key of Life for the last 4 or 5 years, then again, you're sadly wasting your time, because you should be. If you buy it on vinyl, it's a triple LP. It's got two long players and a little 45 as well. It's incredible. This is my favourite track off it, and we're going to jump in halfway through because it's the best bit. Loving you until the day that we get the day.
Greenspan warned in his 2007 book, The Age of Turbulence, that the world might need double-digit interest rates to control inflation in the near future. Rates have been near zero for the vast majority of the time since.
Okay, so microeconomics, very briefly, what's the problem?
Microeconomics is all about, you want to know the problem or you want to know what it is? I'll tell you what it is.
Yeah.
It's all about the interactions between individuals and firms and how they make decisions.
Great. Perfect segue into our experiment. So this is all about personal decisions. Okay, so if you're listening at home, I've got my £10.
What's the name of this game?
It's called the Ultimatum Game.
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay, and Rob and producer Yaz, you are my two people.
Okay? To be experimented on.
To be experimented on. Now, Rob, I'm going to give you this £10.
Are you giving it to me in real life?
I'm giving it to you.
And it's, ladies and gentlemen at home, this is a real tenner as well.
Yeah.
This show
is so expensive for me this week. Now, the only catch in this is you can't have all of it. You have to give some of it to Yaz, because, she should get some too. But I'm going to let you choose how much you offer her. Now, Yaz, you have a little bit of power here.
Okay.
You can decide if you accept or reject his offer. If you accept it, you both get some money.
Yeah.
And if you reject it, no one gets any money. Okay.
Okay.
So, Rob, what are you going to offer her?
Ooh. So, if Yaz rejects my offer, no one gets anything.
No.
So, you go home with the tenner.
Yes.
Oh, dear. I don't want to. Since I'm the guest, I feel like I should probably have 8.
Okay.
Leave you with 2.
Well, that's not even close to half, so...
£2, come on!
It is £2 for nothing, but when there's the potential of £10 in play, it does seem less appealing than almost nothing.
£2 could get you an espresso in some of the cheaper coffee outlets in Soho.
It could, or a filter coffee.
What's it making you feel, Yaz?
It's making me feel like... Before I had nothing... And now, inexplicably, £2 is worse than that. And that does seem logical.
Because you had, the potential for 5.
I had the potential.
So it's almost like you've lost 3.
That was my idea.
There was no potential for that. I was never going to offer you 5. Why would I do that?
I thought you might.
No.
You really wanted me to agree.
So this is such an interesting game, because you're right, Yaz. £2 for nothing. If you were a machine or a computer, you should say yes to any amount of money, because anything is better than nothing. That's the rational decision, to be like, yeah. But we're all humans, and we do. We have this weird, no, it's not fair. You should have given me more, because if I'd had, why did you get offered the £10 and not me? And there was nothing in it. I just randomly gave it to Rob. So it's a really good example, I think, of how we're not always rational in our decisions.
Yeah. And the fact that this is even an interesting thing for microeconomics is a pretty shocking fact about the discipline of microeconomics, because it doesn't take a genius to work out what's going to happen. If I offer producer as 1p, she's not going to take 1p and leave me with 9.99. There's just no way, because A, 1p is not even worth having. It's worse to have to carry a 1p around than it is to not have to carry a 1p around. So there's a question of money is valued differently depending on how much there is of it. So you don't value 1p more than 0p. So that already is problematic. But also, clearly, watching my grinning face walk away with 9.99, that hurts producer Yaz.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's nothing worse than the face of a satisfied economist. That's awful. and so she values not having to see my greedy face walk away with $9.99.
Yeah, like having that power to be like, no, you were unfair, so...
Yeah, to exercise the teeny bit of power that she's been given in this situation. So what microeconomics doesn't... And that is still studied. I mean, there are still papers that use the ultimatum game as a real-life experiment where they get grad students in to do certain things and they give them a fiver and they say, how weird, these grad students didn't accept 50p, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, okay, so there's so much going on there.
Yeah. I did a couple of tests with other people before the show, and I've edited them together, and there are quite a lot of other things that come up. So if we just have a listen to it now, and then we can discuss.
£5.
I would give half. I'd give £5.
Why? £5.
Why would you give
because
five?
Because it's fair.
Should I give you £5? Because that's fair. And she's my pal.
Because then we'll both approve it.
Yeah, I'll accept £5.
Well, I thought if we were both coming away with exactly the equal amount of stuff, then she'd be more likely to accept it. She wouldn't have thought it was weighted in my favour.
How low do you think you could have gone?
I reckon I could have taken it to 7 for me and 3 for her.
Okay, the part of me that is money grabbing is like, now I'd have taken the 4.
Yeah, why would you reject it?
Yeah.
I was just giving you £4. You definitely wouldn't.
Yeah, like £4 for nothing. But then, at the same time, like, you should have given me a fiver.
If they're my friend, then I'd probably go for the...
50-50.
Yeah.
But if it was a random mate?
Give them two quid.
I think because I know you, it would always be half. I reckon I could give you lower and you'd accept it, but yeah. I would always give
it. So, like, a rando, I'd give, like, £4.
Probably £1, I'd say. I don't like small change.
But then I'm going to reject it if you don't. So no one's going to get money.
What's the lowest you think you'd accept from a random person?
Any is less than none.
10p?
Sure. And 10p richer.
But you'd be pissed about it, though.
Why?
Because...
I've not lost out on anything.
True, but they're being really greedy and unfair.
Why are they greedy and unfair?
Because they should give you half.
Well, anything above one is better than nothing, and nothing is the alternative. But like, I reckon what people do is quite often they shoot themselves in the foot because there's this sense of what is fair. But I reckon most people would accept like £4.
Like anything right now is like 3 days before payday.
I love that bit at the end. Yeah. If it's before payday, I'd accept a lot more.
That's amazing.
Very, very true. So there's lots of stuff coming up there. Like one thing that struck me as the person doing it was actually each time I just grabbed two people who knew each other.
Yeah.
And I think that it's different if it's a randomer. And
yes,
it's also different if they are not standing with you. So when I'm saying to them, okay, but if it was a randomer, and that random person is now someone in their imagination, whereas if it's in the same room as you and Yaz were, it's a lot harder to, I think, get away with it.
So they have done these experiments. They've played the game like via a kind of internet link where the people never meet each other. They know that they will never meet each other and they'll never play the game again with one another. And people still reject the 1p offers. What makes a difference is if you know that you're going to play the game several times,
then everyone's fair.
Yeah, then that completely changes the dynamics. So what's interesting about that is that it tells you that, and I think one of the reasons why Londoners can seem so unfriendly is because they're playing a series of one-off ultimatum games.
Yeah, because it's such a big city, you're very unlikely to ever...
Yeah, you're never going to meet anybody ever again.
Meet the same bus driver or whatever.
There's no need for you to offer the person on the tube your seat because you'll never see them again. It doesn't matter. You know, people behave very badly when they think they're not going to see the person again. And
or they think there's no consequences. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I like two things to say about that little piece, which was great. Somebody said... that people will shoot themselves in the foot, even, you know, just because they feel like it's unfair. I think the thing about saying you're going to shoot yourself in the foot is to realize that, and this is really important for economics, that money is a measurable thing, but it's not the only thing that matters to you. So things like pride and things like a sense of justice are not just abstract nonsenses. They're real for the person that's experiencing them, and they're as real as getting a 50p or not getting 50p. So I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I'm guessing that's never included in your microeconomics models.
No. And again, I have some sympathy because those things are hard to include.
Really hard, yes.
I wondered whether the guy who said, no, well, I mean, 1p is still better than nothing, the only people apparently who universally accept 1p offers are people who studied economics at undergraduate. So I wonder whether he was an economist or...
Oh, I've got no idea. Okay. But he is a researcher on a robot TV show, so I just teased him that he was like the machine.
Right, yeah. And he's behaving like a perfect robot.
Rationally accept anything. Right, time for your third song. What are we having next?
Okay, this is a song by The Pretenders, sung by Chrissie Hynde, and it's called Don't Get Me Wrong. And I chose this because the lyrics are beautiful in a very unexpected way, and if they catch you at the right moment, it can be quite a tearjerker. Get me wrong. If I split like you think.
In 2008, the consensus from forecasters was that not a single economy would fall into recession in 2009.
Well, they were very wrong.
Enough said about that.
So for this section, you had told me as well that there's a lot of reasons why austerity is maybe not the best thing that the government could have done, or their justification for it is not quite right. And I'm intrigued because a lot of people are not very happy about us being in austerity, but it's pitched to us like this is our only option. So please tell me all.
Yeah, I mean, if you want a study of how to control a storyline, then the 2010 election and everything that followed is probably the best example I've ever seen of political storyline orchestration, because the storyline is basically Labour spent all of the money, there's none left, we haven't got any, so we can't spend any money, so all we can do now for the next 5 years is just spend less and less and less and less and less until eventually we're back in balance.
Yeah,
and there's nothing we can do about that. It was called, I can now refer to it in the past tense because Cameron has gone off to be on a beach, it was called the long-term economic plan, and basically the plan was to stop spending money, and that is a great thing to do, I think, if you've got no money and you're an individual or a household. If you're an individual or a household, let's say for my 200 quid that I'm getting for doing this, I don't know why you keep laughing about that. Let's say I go out now and decide to spend all of that money on jam, right?
Yeah.
Now you would say to me that's a foolish way to spend your money. You're being incredibly profligate. Right, because...
Yes, I would use a very long word like that.
You should use a word like profligate. It's a good word. It means that you spend all your money on jam.
Right, okay. word of the day.
Yeah, so what you would say is, why don't you spend that money on something more sensible, or even better, keep it, right? So for me, it's very important to keep my money because if I run out of money, I'm in serious trouble. And there are several reasons for that. One, I can't make my own money.
Yeah.
I've tried making my own money. So I'm quite a good drawer. I'm a reasonable good drawer, and I can draw a pretty good likeness of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
Yeah.
So I did one of my good likenesses on a piece of paper and wrote, you know,
I promised to pay the bearer.
Exactly. I went for five. I started low.
Oh, okay.
And I was quite literally laughed out of KFC, which is a very humiliating experience for me. So I can't make my own money. That's the first reason why it's bad if I run out. The second reason it's bad if I run out... is that I'm very small. So I'm economically utterly insignificant.
Just for any listeners, Rob is actually really quite tall, so I'm quite confused by this.
So I spend a lot of money in KFC. I like to buy a family dipper bucket, and I usually try and eat that on my own. But if I stopped going to KFC three times a day... KFC would not go out of business.
Oh, you're a small player.
I'm a small player in the economics business. Not only that, but KFC, they wouldn't even register it on their annual
they got
reports.
Loads of customers.
They wouldn't mind. They wouldn't even notice that one family bucket had gone astray.
Yeah.
Whereas if the government stops spending money, then that really matters, because when the government buys big things, they create economic activity. We were talking earlier on about the ant hill.
Yeah.
And shaking the anthill.
When they pay for things, more people have jobs, and then more people can spend money on their other things, and just
exactly.
So lubricates the whole system.
The government is a big player, and when the government stops spending money, that means that people who would otherwise have been the recipients of that money no longer have jobs. And ideally, the government is spending the money in the UK or in the country of the government. So let's say the government decides to build a high-speed rail link between London and... Where is it?
Manchester? Birmingham?
I haven't done my HS2 research. Anyway, London and some non-London place. Let's face it, that's what London people think HS2 is. It's a connection to somewhere outside of zone. No, we don't know where it is. That means that British people get jobs. That means that you have to buy steel, you have to buy wood, you have to do stuff. People have to go there. People have to be there and wear high vis and hats and stuff. So all of that stuff, that's economic activity. And when the government decides not to spend that money, those people are then not wearing a hard hat and high vis. They're sitting at home on their sofa, potentially, possibly unemployed. Now, that has a huge cost to society. And not just in the way that people think, oh, well, then you have to pay their unemployment benefit.
Yeah.
But there is a non-monetary cost to society of having lots of people out of work.
Self-esteem because self-esteem as well.
There's a question of self-esteem. There's a question of community cohesion and society.
Or like people graduating and loads of student debt and then they can't pay it off.
Yes. And I think that also society in the big sense is a kind of consensus. It only works if people are broadly willing to say, okay, so I can't drive in reverse at 50 miles an hour the wrong way down the motorway. And I can't, for example, build a massive sound system on my roof and have 24-hour parties. But I wish I could do that. But I'm willing to make the trade and not do those things because I feel like society is good for me and I can see that there are benefits and I partake in it.
You sort of respect the norms. Yeah.
Exactly. So if the government has no interest in maintaining a state of like, good unemployment, good employment, and people having a share in society, then they shouldn't be surprised when people act as if they don't have a stake in society. So that there are broader costs to not allowing people to fulfil their economic potential that are nothing to do with money and are nothing to do with benefits.
And if they hadn't sort of said, "Okay, there's no money, we're going to stop borrowing as much," like if they just carried on, would it all have ended in like Armageddon, or would it have been fine?
The argument for austerity basically revolves around something called credit rating agencies. Now, without wanting to be too boring about it, you will have heard the name weirdly. So Fitch and Moody's and Standard and Poor's.
Yeah, there's like three companies, aren't there?
Yeah, there are three companies that effectively run the world. They, for no reason whatsoever, they are household names. And that brings me on to another of my bugbears, which is why would a rating agency be a household name? But they are, for whatever reason. People have heard of them. And basically their job is to look at companies and entities and say, we've looked at this company and we think that if you invest money in that company, it's either not very likely to go bust or very likely to go bust. So it's supposed to give investors a sense of, okay, this is a good company, it's doing well, I can invest my money in it and I can be certain that they're not going to go bust and I'll get my money back or I'll even make a profit. And that's where the rating comes in. So the rating basically is we look at your books, we look at your accounts, and we say, yeah, we're giving you a AAA, which means there's no way you're going bust, or we're giving you a AA or a B or whatever, and it goes down.
And so what, the more you're borrowing, the less good your rating type
of thing? Well, so, and then at some point, now, I think this was in the kind of financialization boom in the early 80s, credit ratings agencies started rating governments, which... when you just stop and think about it, it's totally bonkers.
When you're just like a little company, yeah.
Yeah, they're a company with a finite number of people whose job it is to rate basically every creditable entity in the world, now including governments. So they're expected to send somebody out to look at Britain and look around, go to Westminster Abbey and have a look and go, and then maybe sort of like, you know, go up along Hadrian's Wall and go, and all the while they've got their little notebook. And then after their 2 weeks of walking around Hadrian's Wall and going to see, you know, Giant's Causeway and whatever, they go, this seems like a trustworthy country. We're going to give it a AAA. And what that means is that investors then can feel confident in lending the government money. So all of that was a very long way of basically saying the reason why we had to do austerity is because if we were shown to be profligate, spending all of our money on jam, then the ratings agencies would say, well, this is a very profligate government. You shouldn't lend money to it because there's a good chance it will go bust.
Yeah.
Now, if the ratings agencies say that, then people, because
they're only
four,
you money.
They will stop lending you money. And not only that, but they will take their money out of the country.
So okay,
the money
so then you are in a worse situation.
And then it becomes real. So then you really are, that you really are stuck. Now, what has actually happened is that the cost of government to borrow money from foreign investors, and foreign investors are people like people who manage people's pension funds.
Yeah.
So they've got billions of pounds. They want to try and make a return. They don't know what to do with
it. So they invest in lots of different things.
Yeah, they invest in lots of different things. And what they're trying to do is make a return, and they're trying to make it safely. So what they're looking for is governments who they suspect that their economy will grow. That's where the return comes from. And they're expecting that the economies are not going to totally tank.
Yeah.
That's where the security comes from.
So they're not going to lose their money. Yeah,
exactly. And at the moment, the rates that the government can borrow from those financial investors, from those foreign investors at, are historically and comedically low. So if you lend money to the government for 5 years, I looked this up yesterday, you can expect a return of 0.19% on your money.
So now, there's like not much point giving it to the government?
If you take inflation into account, you are losing mega amounts of money on the money that you've put into government at the moment. I mean, so when the interest rates are lower than inflation, what's happening is that basically your money is losing value faster than it's gaining interest. And that is true at the moment in spades for borrowing to the UK government. In other words, the UK government is seen as an insanely reliable and trustworthy source of money.
But you're not going to get a return.
Well, it doesn't matter, because from our perspective, all that means is we should borrow. We should be borrowing all the money that we can, because it doesn't cost us anything.
Right.
It costs us less to borrow money than the inflation would
get rid
of that money.
Yeah, okay, I get it, sorry.
So
yeah.
we could just go on an absolute borrowing splurge and do all of the stuff that I was talking about, invest in infrastructure, build a high-speed rail link from London to a non-London other place. I'm sure there are some.
A city in the north.
And it wouldn't cost us anything. And the austerity fans would say, but if we start doing that, then our credit, it will get more expensive. But I would say there must be some happy medium. There must be some place between not borrowing any money at all, when it's literally historically cheap to do it. We'd be nuts not to be borrowing money like crazy. Except it's become a kind of thing that you can't even mention.
Yeah.
Because of this thing about narrative, I was telling you about story. Labour spent all the money, we haven't got any money. So the last thing that a government wants to do is say, what we're going to do is borrow money and invest in public services and infrastructure. Because the idea of borrowing more money, the deficit. Why do people know what the deficit is? That's so weird. Like, it doesn't affect anybody. It has nothing to do with us, but we find out about it because it's part of the narrative.
Yeah.
So the deficit has become the bogeyman in this era. And even, so there's no debate, left wing, right wing, nobody thinks it's a good idea to borrow money at historically cheap rates and run up a deficit, because it's just become this kind of...
something you're scared of. You're scared of being in too much
debt. Exactly. Everyone is terrified of the deficit, as if something horrible is going to happen.
It's funny, like... my friend is an economist. I don't know why I can't say that word.
It's a hard word, because you also have to choose between economist and economist.
Yeah, so he's an economist, and he was saying basically the world has an addiction problem and everyone is addicted to borrowing, and like all the countries have been borrowing money for so long that to stop the cycle, it's going to be very painful. And like, it's almost like the government decided, okay, we're going to do it, take a little bit of the hit now, and we're just having to take that hit, and we didn't really have a choice in it.
Yeah, well, so I mean, that is exactly the narrative. The narrative is exactly, we've been borrowing for years, and it's not good.
But like you said, a government is different to a person. So yes, if I've like maxed out my credit card, okay, I need to stop spending and stop borrowing so much until I'm back to normal, because it's just not very safe if I've got zero reserves. But, yeah, a government is a bigger player and is spending its money on other things, not just jam.
Not just jam, yeah. So a government is spending money on things which are productive for the economy, in a way that KFC is not productive for the economy. But education and roads and healthcare, those are things which are productive, which are going to help the economy. Because actually, the deficit is measured as something called a debt-to-GDP ratio. And all that means is that you take the level of debt, you divide it by what we produce in a country, and that's your number. That's a good. And if the number is high, that's bad. And if the number's low, that's good. But debt to GDP ratio has two things in it. It has the debt and it has the GDP.
So actually, if they were borrowing money, they'd just be bringing the GDP up, and that would still bring
the
debt down.
So you could either reduce the debt or you could increase the GDP.
Wow.
And by reducing the debt, what you're doing is you're making the government look good and you're making everyone else shafted, and you're ruining public services for a generation. And if you decide to increase GDP, then okay, there's the risks that sometime down the line the rating agencies might have a look at you again. But you know, you're investing in the future and you're making the country a better place to be and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And also...
And who knows, other things can happen before the rating agencies come, like the sea levels could rise, like you just don't know.
Exactly. And the ratings agencies, they are only looking at you in comparison to everyone else. So with the world in total turmoil...
So if the whole world was to take that hit, you could still come out quite well.
Yeah, I mean, look at the European... No one is going to say that the European Union is a great place to invest your money at the moment.
No.
So there's this whole... The biggest market in the world is kind of out of the game in terms of who's the best government to lend money to. So, and with the whole Trump thing happening right at the moment, the US, you know,
they're not great either.
Exactly. So,
and everyone's worried about China taking over.
Where are these safe havens that the government is terrified that all of these pension funds are going to take their money away from if we start actually doing something to help our economy? There are none.
Oh, that's fascinating. I feel like I have understood it, and I've never understood it before. I did just think the deficit was a big, scary hole, and that it was right that we were trying to get out of it. But
should be.
Yeah. Song number four.
Song number four I heard this at 2 o'clock in the morning, driving back from a gig in Suffolk, and it was on Radio 3, which is amazing during the night. It's like super boring during the day. Sorry, Radio 3 fans. And at about 11 o'clock, it starts to get mega weird and mega
that.
Amazing. Yeah, it's incredible. I think, is Ray Charles's finest vocal performance. It also features, sorry, podcast listeners, because you might not get to hear it. It also features my favourite piano solo of all time. So it's Ray Charles on the piano and singing "The Sun's Gonna Shine Again."
That you'd always be mine. Yeah, Lord, it would always treat me kind. But still, I love.
In 2007, Bernie Madoff said, "In today's regulatory environment, it's virtually impossible to violate the rules. This is something that the public really don't understand. It's impossible for a violation to go undetected." A year later, investigators discovered Madoff's Ponzi scheme had cost his investors $65 billion.
News just in. Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan plan to eradicate all disease by 2100.
South Africa is about to introduce a sugar tax on fizzy drinks.
Alpine goat man wins Ig Nobel Prize.
Humanity is driving an unprecedented marine extinction.
The Office for National Statistics says that there's been no fallout from the Brexit referendum vote.
And fitness trackers are less effective than nothing at all.
And head of transplant team's new animal tests fail to convince critics. Great, some really... really interesting stories out there this week. I am intrigued by your Alpine goat man, Yaz.
I love the Ig Nobel Prizes. They're great. So basically what they are is they're awarded for sort of what I think things are actually tackling real issues or something. You know, it's a real scientist doing something, trying to do some real research, but they kind of go about it in a really strange way. So this is a British man who lived in the Alps as a goat for 3 days. So if you can look him up online, his name is, I think, Thomas Thwaites, and he made these sort of stilts that his for his hands and legs, and he's just sort of hung out in the Alps with some
he's
goats.
He's walking on all fours.
He's walking around on all fours.
Is he eating grass?
Yeah, he lived
oh
as a goat.
God.
He took a break from being human, as he put it.
I always
it,
thought goats ate goat. Coats.
I think they eat kind of anything, don't they?
The only thing I've ever seen a goat eat is people's clothing.
Bits of plastic from the food you're trying to
feed
them,
yeah. Why did he do it?
I think he just sort of wanted to take a break from being a person. It's sort of what his, but he spent, to be fair, he spent about a year researching how he was going to do this and designing it, and just sort of basically to understand the life of a goat from the perspective of a goat.
Wow. The things that happen in science.
I know.
So my story was about Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan, and they have... created the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and they're going to be giving away 99% of all their kind of Facebook profits, which is an estimated $3 billion over the next decade. To invest in companies and organizations conducting medical research, which is kind of great. It's like the next Bill Gates, I think, almost.
Yes, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yeah, and they believe that by the they just want to kind of eradicate all diseases, and that by the end of the century they think the average life expectancy could have increased to 100. So two of the projects they've already invested in, one is Cell Atlas, which seeks to map the location, types and molecular property of all the cells in the body, which is kind of amazing. And then the other one is their infectious disease initiative, and they're hoping it will develop new tests and vaccines for HIV, even Ebola and Zika viruses.
Hooray. Yeah. So, hooray for Facebook.
Yeah.
I'll tell you an amazing fact about Facebook. So the global economy now works via advertising revenue. As we know, that they basically can't squeeze any more money out of people other than by advertising at them. And globally, 80% of all advertising revenue generated in the world goes to either Google or Facebook.
Oh, my God.
That's why they're the only two companies left.
So it's good that they're actually doing something. Like, when I saw that headline, I was a bit like, oh, God, Facebook's taking over medicine now. But I don't know. At least if they've got all that money, at least they're using it in a nice way. We think the Bill and Melinda
Gates Foundation has, on balance, actually been a good thing. And I think that the development community has a bit of a complaint every now and again, but they're just jealous because there's so much money swashing around.
Mm. And then a less happy one, this unprecedented marine extinction. So there's been 5 major extinctions in the past. And people sort of talk about our effect on the planet is the 6th extinction. And what's quite scary is in all of the other extinctions, none of the large marine animals died out. Whereas in this one, we're killing off things like great white sharks and blue whales and the bluefin tuna, and being pushed to the brink. So they haven't gone yet, but they are getting very small. And actually, this has never happened in the past. And it might have serious, serious repercussions for like millions of years on the marine ecosystem.
The US and China just signed up to the Paris Climate Agreements, though, on the flip side of that. So
progress is
perhaps maybe about to start being made.
Great.
That's an Obama legacy. In case you're wondering what Obama's legacy is, that's one of them. They actually ratified the climate agreement.
He's so great, Obama. I'm going to miss him. What is your 5th song, Rob?
My 5th song is something from my teenage years. I couldn't resist throwing something in from the mid-90s that all of our listeners and everyone else in the world would be too young to know. It's a song by the Long Pigs, and it's very beautiful, and it's called On and On.
All the songs I've sung, more often than you know, 'cause you're the Lord that I've come to. More often than I've let it show. And I wish you would leave me. And then I wish you would go. And then I wish you didn't need me. And I wish I didn't love.
Rob, very quickly, what can we do to make economics better? We've talked about what's wrong with it, so how can we make it a bit more right?
Yes, I mean, I think that there is plenty of scope for economics to do good in the world. I also think, by the way, that economics has actually done an incredible amount of good in the world. I think that people who get too occupied with complaining about how everything's terrible need to just have a quick look around where they are. Are they A, in like a barren wasteland running away from dinosaurs and meteorites, or are they B, sitting in a warm, heated room, not fearing for their lives, not having lost their teeth at 5 and not having died of diarrhea at the age of 2? So I think that economic progress actually has a lot to.
And what you were saying about comparing it to like the weather in the ocean, like we still can't predict the weather accurately. It's too complicated. And, you know, our world is complicated, so They're doing a good try.
Yeah, fair enough to the world of economists. I think what they should potentially do is start thinking of economics more in the way that people think about anthropology. Anthropology is something where you want to know about a certain human phenomenon. You don't sit and theorise about it. You go out into the world and you watch that human phenomenon unfolding in front of your very eyes. So I expect to see economists in households, in businesses, in central banks and in governments just watching what's happening and taking notes and writing qualitative reports about how these structures of power actually work from the inside. I also think that economics would benefit from being better communicated. I think that there are things that economics knows about And decisions that have to be made economically are often not made in, from a very informed standpoint, because economics doesn't do a very good job of communicating itself.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know any of that austerity stuff. And I remember being younger and my dad being like, I'm going to teach you how to read the FT and understand the stock markets.
Amazing.
And like, I think I got it a little bit, but I don't remember it now.
People should be able to read the Financial Times. They should be able to read The Economist. It's not actually that complicated. And one website that I contribute to, that I want to give a little plug to, is called economy.org. And their job is basically to try and make economics understandable. And I think that projects like that and rethinking economics that it came out of are really exciting. And I think that it's a really exciting time to be an economist at the moment.
Yeah. Unprecedented, like we said. Well, all we've got time for now is to reveal the results of our brain teaser. Producer Yaz, have we had any guesses?
We have had a guess, and I actually think they've got it right. I don't know the answer myself, so do tell me.
Do you have any guesses for yourself?
I had absolutely no idea, but when I had this answer told to me, I did think, oh, that would make sense.
Can I say my answer?
Yeah, go.
I'm pretty sure I know what it is. Is it that the hotel is on the top of a really tall hill, and when the guy drives there, because of the extra altitude and the pressure difference, his brain explodes, at which point, legally, you are considered to be bankrupt if your brain explodes.
Yeah. So I thought maybe when I first heard this, had he like crashed into the hotel and then had loads of like bills?
Yeah.
But it's not that.
So the contribution from Ellen is a little bit more abstract, that he was playing Monopoly.
Oh, yeah. She's got it. Well done, Ellen. Thank you for tweeting in. Yeah, so a real riddle. Monopoly, land on the hotel, lose all your money. And with that, it's time to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And what is your final song going
to
be?
My last song, I scratched my head about which Beatles track to select, because I've got to have to pick one. I picked And Your Bird Can Sing off Revolver.